Dr. Laura Hannes-Webb, author of The Gift of ADHD, and today I'm excited to be talking with George Hatcher, who is a real rocket scientist. And not only is he a rocket scientist, but he is one of 100 people, those 100 chosen out of more than 200,000 people, chosen as a finalist in what's called the Mars One Project. And that project has gotten a lot of controversy of late, but kind of makes it is part of what we're here to talk about. So welcome, George.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, one of the reasons that we were going to be talking with each other was because of your interest also in space tourism. And one of, for example, Virgin Galactic is planning on having manned flights to low Earth orbit. And, you know, people are talking about space flight becoming routine like an airliner, and that some of these will be happening, you know, in maybe 10 years we'll be seeing things like this. And so one of my questions, which was going to be one of the purposes of our interview, was how do we train civilians, people, to be prepared to go into microgravity or to approach space as a tourist? But before we get to that substance of that, it's just impossible to resist talking about the controversy around Mars One. And, of course, me as a psychologist cannot resist wanting to know, what is it that drives a person to sign up for a mission, which is a one-way ticket to Mars? And so I'll just let you take over.
Okay. Well, you know, the one-way aspect of Mars is not the attraction of the project.
Right.
It's a necessary aspect of the project. So people who signed up for this didn't sign up for it because it was one way.
Mm-hmm.
They signed up for it in spite of it being one way. And that speaks to the drive that these individuals have for exploration.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a similar drive that you would find among people who do any sort of dangerous endeavor that would seek to expand the knowledge of humanity, whether it's the first person to summit a mountain or the first person to set a new route on a rock face in Yosemite or the first person to physically visit the bottom of the Marianas Trench or the first person to design a heat suit so that they could descend into the caldera of a volcano. So these are things that on the face of it, you're going to have a huge slice of the population that says these people are crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an element. You have to be a little bit daring. You have to be perhaps a little bit more acceptable of risk than the average person to pursue some of these ideas. So the idea behind Mars One is getting humans on Mars. The reason that it's one way is because it's 10 times cheaper than bringing people back.
Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the other things is that I think, you know, my personal reaction the first time I heard about Mars One was, I think, like the rest of the population. Like, I'll just be honest with you, I didn't really take it that seriously. One of the things that, you know, piqued my interest is when I went down to Kennedy Space Center with the NASA Social, with a group of really amazing 50 people there to see the SpaceX rocket launch. I was really amazed by one, Elon Musk, the CEO of SpaceX, is on record as saying, the reason I haven't taken SpaceX public is the goals of SpaceX are very long-term, which is to establish a city on Mars. So, and here's a person who, you know, has sort of a track record of doing things that seem impossible. And then also, I was not at all aware of this until my trip, but NASA is completely, the ultimate mission is to go to Mars, and they're, you know, 100% moving towards that. So,
right.
So the actual overall idea is not unique to Mars One. It has, Elon Musk is also on record as saying, you know, they really don't have the money to probably make it happen. But what you're saying, though, is that for the psychology of why someone would sign up for something like this is, well, you know, why did people found the United States or travel across the ocean or all these other things? and that there's a certain type of person for whom that's the ultimate meaning of life is discovery and exploration.
That's right. And also, I should point out, Elon Musk is also on record as saying that if Mars One does raise the money, he is happy to sell him rockets.
Oh, I had no idea about that.
Yeah. So he's pragmatic about it as well. I mean, he's definitely a savvy businessman. So he's not at all against Mars One. He's just skeptical. And it's natural to be skeptical. And it's also, it's reasonable to be skeptical because the money is not raised yet. But just because it's not raised doesn't mean it can't be raised.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so there's a lot of other controversy, too, of course, about the one-way aspect to it, but I don't really want us to spend a lot of time talking about that because it's not really the focus of our conversation, but maybe another time. And, you know, one of the things that you mentioned, which I was completely unaware of, was if you could say some more about how many people have ever been to space and comparing that to, for example, how many billionaires there are on the planet.
Sure. I ran across an article just the other day that really helped put it in perspective for me, because when you start to learn the details of space exploration and the history of space exploration, you know, going back to the space race with the USSR and the United States, and then you see other countries gradually coming online, and then now we have private industries that are capable of putting rockets into low Earth orbit, and very soon we'll have private companies that put private astronauts into orbit. It's still a very small number. It's just over 500 people who have ever been to space. And we're talking about, you know, beyond the Kármán line, beyond 100 kilometers in altitude, and then the next step would be people who have actually achieved orbital velocity and gone into low Earth orbit. And the Russians did that first. Interestingly, the United States did not send a human to orbit first, they sent a human to subspace, you know, on a vertical flight that came back down in the Atlantic Ocean. But the Russians just went for it, as far as we know. I mean, obviously, there's still a lot of secrecy surrounding the Russian space program. But as far as we know, since Gagarin was successful, he went into orbit first. So that number is still tiny. I mean, you have to think, every American astronaut, so the Mercury 7, the Apollo astronauts, all the shuttle astronauts, and every cosmonaut that ever went to space, every European astronaut, and then every astronaut who came from other countries but flew on Russian rockets or American rockets, and now that we have Taikonauts, you know, we have the Long March rocket and that China is sending humans into space and has their own plans to build an independent space station, all of those people combined is just over 500. So I always say less than 600 because the number can change with each new mission. So less than 600 people have ever been in space in all of human history. And today, not counting royalty and not counting dictators, we have more than 1,500 billionaires. And I haven't seen a number that aggregates the number of lottery winners worldwide, but I'm certain that it's higher than the number of billionaires.
Of course,
so
yeah.
When you're looking at these things that are that rare, you know, a person who has $1 billion, of whom Elon Musk is one.
Right.
And less than a third of that number have ever been into space. If you are the kind of person who's serious and pragmatic about wanting to be an astronaut or wanting to go to space in today's world, in the world before you can pay your way to space via tourism and get on Virgin Galactic or visit a space hotel when Bigelow Aerospace puts inflatable habitats into orbit, or before SpaceX starts selling orbital flights, when they get to the point where, you know, their rockets are so routine that they're launching every week or multiple times a week, then you got to be realistic and realize that this being an astronaut, getting to space, is rarer than winning the lottery. It's rarer than being a billionaire.
Wow. And it makes sense after you say it because, as you said, it's really, been 50 years since we've been, less than 50 years since we've been sending people to space, and the expense is so great that number would be this low. But it really highlights that for someone like you, whose lifelong dream has been to go to space, that what this means to you and why someone like you, who is literally a rocket scientist and getting a PhD in, what is your PhD in? It's in planetary science?
It's in planetary science, that's right.
And for someone like you, you have to take every chance you can get to find that avenue to space, because it's not, as you had said at one point, you know, you can't put your happiness on getting to space, even though it has been your lifelong dream, because statistically the chances are just so low of that happening. But again, you know, coming back to what you're calling kind of the primary drive, which is this need to discover, this need to explore, wanting to be, you know, the person who makes the difference, you know, I can't help but just to, you know, mention that, you know, my area of expertise is ADHD. So those traits are just so familiar to me. And not that I actually have any astronauts as clients, but, and, you know, some of the research on ADHD has suggested that it is, of course, a very stimulation-seeking, but also genetically related to nomadic tribes, so that there's a subset of humans that seem to be designed to need to keep moving nomadically. And, again, it kind of fits in with Elon Musk's, you know, quote that really what we are now, you know, trying to establish is an interplanetary species, which it just seems to be an extension of the nomadic tribe, which is you just keep have to find a new place, new resources.
This is part of our history as humans. This is part of the fiber of our being, is exploration and really moving ourselves physically to new places, crossing new mountain ranges, finding new vistas, exploring new lands. You can find elements of this in religion. I mean, you can look at Exodus. You can look at Christian traditions and see people moving into the promised land. So I think that we are going to be exploring and expanding and settling and exploiting the resources of the universe as long as we're alive as a species. It seems to me to be our destiny.
And, you know, I think I mentioned to you that before my trip to NASA, it really sounded more like science fiction to me. And then I remembered, you know, for example, there was once a congressional hearing about the dangers of these new things that were called horseless carriages. And, you know, one of the things that was raised was, could the human body sustain the possibility of going 40 miles an hour or higher? You know, and that was a
right.
matter of debate. And then the dangers, you know, of the what kind of death toll would it be that if they were these horseless carriages going 40 miles an hour or higher, you know, that would be a tremendous danger to the well-being of everyone else. And so I do think of things like that as it's a fairly new development for me to see this as not being science fiction. But, you know, I do think of things like that, and I think, do I really want to be that old fogey that refuses to think, you know, that it could be possible?
Well, history has a lot of lessons for us. And so automobiles are a great example. When there is a potential for a new idea, then naysayers just find their way out of the woodwork. Not only do you have the people who were like, oh, you know, can the body withstand 40 miles an hour, not understanding that really basic Newtonian physics, that once you reach that velocity, there are no forces on your body if you maintain a constant velocity. You know, it's the same as sitting in your living room going 40 miles an hour, and we can all prove that today when we drive around in our cars. You're on the highway, you're doing 70 miles an hour, you're not feeling any accelerations. It's just like sitting on your couch at home. There were the same naysayers when we were trying to break the sound barrier with rocket planes that looked at the equations for compressible flow and told Chuck Yeager that he was going to hit a brick wall in the sky if you tried to break the sound barrier.
Wow.
Because the equations, the Bernoulli's equations show that drag goes to infinity. So he would just disintegrate, and that would be it, and you're foolish for even trying. Now, there was some substance to that because people had died chasing that goal of going supersonic. But once he did it with a rocket plane, and there was evidence, you know, we knew that things came into Earth's atmosphere from outer space, bolides, meteors, they were definitely going faster than the speed of sound. And some of them reached the ground. So it was possible to go supersonic, but people weren't thinking about it that way. They were looking at the equations they had and said, if you extrapolate this, it's impossible. But he did it, and then that rewrites the textbooks, and it takes the naysayers and shows them that it's possible. So then you have to accept the fact that at a certain point, Bernoulli's equations break down. And you have to have a new theory of compressible flow, and then of transonic flow, and then supersonic and hypersonic, and the field of aerodynamics goes forward. So there are examples throughout history of when a new idea comes along, there's resistance to change, and there's plenty of people who are going to say it's impossible. With the moon landing, there were scientists who said, well, we can't be certain what the composition of the regolith on the surface of the moon is. And so people told Neil Armstrong, it's possible that if you land there and the plates on the bottom of your landing craft allow you to float on the surface of the dust, that when you step off the end of the ladder, you're going to fall 50 feet into loose, airy dust and disappear and never be heard from again. So
wow.
These are the risks that people take. These are the unknowns that you face when you are out there exploring frontiers, whether it's the speed of sound or whether it's the surface of the moon or whether it's going to Mars. And so it's really, really easy from the comfort of your couch or in front of your keyboard to list a litany of reasons why something is not possible. What it takes is someone bold enough to go out there and say, I've analyzed the risk, I've done all of my homework in understanding the physics, I've put forth the money to do the engineering to make this possible, I'm going to do it and we'll see if it works.
You know, I mean, that's so amazing what you're saying, and also relevant to, you know, my area of expertise in that, you know, when you talk about Neil Armstrong facing the possibility that he would step on the moon and just, you know, basically fall into some sort of a sinkhole and never be seen again, and yet he chose to go anyways. And
right.
When you put it in that perspective, and the truth is every single one of us every day has decisions, not on that scale of things. But, you know, this is a more silly example, and if we can use your spirit and the story of Neil Armstrong as kind of inspirations for why we should sometimes take risks, you know, even when I went to the NASA social, you know, I work, I have a family, and the idea that I would, you know, I got short notice, could somehow make it all happen and change my life around to make it happen, I was like, oh, wow, there's a lot of risks here. You know, I'm going to have to make a lot of things happen. You know, and I did go, of course, but every one of us faces barriers and risk to the goals that we have for ourselves. And so I think the extreme nature of the risk that you're facing and all of space travel has involved really can be an inspiration for other people, all of us. But, you know, I also wanted to go back to one of the things that you said about, you know, the issue of space tourism now is you were talking about Newton's laws. And I know that you also were a microgravity coach for zero-G. And so obviously,
that's right.
If something like space tourism is ever going to be real, there's something like weightlessness workshops that have to happen. And I saw that in those workshops, they have to people get trained in Newton's laws. So this would be the most interesting science lesson anyone has ever had. But
when you get to when your body gets to be the experiment, then yes, that's incredible. Before we go to the space tourism, I just want to touch on one thing when it comes to risk.
Okay.
So these risks are not blind risks.
Mm-hmm.
We're not leaping off of cliffs, right?
The
right. People who do leap off of cliffs with wingsuits and base jumpers, they've got 10,000 parachutes jumps behind them.
Yeah.
You see the video online and you're like, wow, that looks amazing. Those people are so crazy. No, those people are cold and calculated. They want to stay alive to jump again. So they've done their homework. They've put in the time. It is hard work. When you want to take risks and you want to face them, facing them means putting forth effort, investigating what they are, and then doing the work to mitigate the risk. You try to minimize it as much as possible. This is part of what NASA does. You engineer things, you create things, and you put together plans that reduce the risk to a level that you're able to accept. So when we face risks in our own individual lives, that's the ethos that we have to bring with us, that you think about it in terms of, I want to attend this event, I have to change all this stuff around, but you put forth effort to change those things around. It wasn't that you just said, okay, I'm buying a plane ticket, guys, take care of yourself. You crossed all your T's and dotted all your I's, and you made it possible by buying down the risk.
Right, that's exactly right, and that's such a great point. And, you know, I was thinking about that, too, because one of the event that I saw was the cargo that's going to the International Space Station, and what are they doing? They're doing research with mice on what happens to people's bones in space and zero gravity. And so the research has been going on so long about what do we, you know, how do we keep people healthy in space? And, you know, I learned that the risks in terms of bone loss, they've basically got that down to almost zero for people in space now, whereas that was a very challenging problem. So there's been decades of research on the questions of how to keep people, human bodies, healthy in space.
Right, and so this is it's multifaceted the way you go about this, because the people who were the first one to spend first ones to spend long amounts of time in space, they just did it, you know?
Yeah.
There's a combination of what you can do. You can theorize. You can look at the scientific data and the scientific theories we have on the ground, and you can speculate about what's going to happen, and you can make informed guesses. And then there's, okay, well, let's just send somebody to the Mir space station. And, oh, by the way, the USSR just fell and the Iron Curtain came down, and I'm sorry, but you're stuck up there as a cosmonaut for a year and a half. So deal with it, you know? And you want to talk about psychology. These are people who didn't even know if they were going to get a resupply of the necessary consumables, if they were going to have enough oxygen to breathe or enough food to eat, or if they would get to go home because the government that supported their spacecraft just fell apart. So this is a multi-pronged effort. Yes, there's been decades of research in keeping humans alive and healthy in space, but while it's been, there's a scientific aspect, there's a laboratory, there's a theoretical aspect, and there's also the doing. We send people to space, find out what goes wrong with them, hope that it's not so detrimental that it costs them their lives, and then we come back and learn from it. So that it's an iterative process, and now we know that astronauts who are in weightlessness perpetually have to work out at least an hour, preferably 2 or 3 hours every single day, so that they can do the things to their bones and to their muscles that we do without even thinking. Like, one of the amazing things about space exploration is how it causes us to realize what we take for granted on the surface of Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Breathable air, an excellent pressure, the temperature range that our body needs to survive and that liquid water needs to pool on the surface, the gravity that when we take a step, we're actually exercising, and it produces microfractures in our bones, and then our body uses all of the food that we eat to rebuild those bones and keep them strong. Just gesturing, like I'm gesturing right now on the phone, I'm moving my arm through a local gravity field and exercising. It's causing my muscles to do work. When you're in microgravity, when you're floating in the International Space Station, zooming around the Earth in orbit, it's free. There's no external gravity field that you're working against. The only thing you're working against is just the inertia of your limbs. And your body says, I don't need to maintain all of this bone density. I don't need to maintain all of this muscle mass. Your body's very efficient, so it just starts leaching your bones. It just starts wasting away your muscles. So you have to find ways to mitigate it. They do it through diet. They do it through some medication, and they do it through exercise. But these are things that we find out as we go along, and it's part of the importance of exploration.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of expanding humanity's knowledge of the cosmos and of ourselves, because we learn about the human body. We learn about all of the things that we didn't really even have a reason to think about, you know, orthostasis, about, you know, how the body pumps blood back up from the bottom of the feet, and that gravity is constantly fighting that, so that if you take gravity away, you get a fluid shift in the body and all the blood pools up in your torso and gives you a puffy face. Like, these are not ideas that the average person or even the average doctor sits around contemplating, but you go to a new place and you learn new things.
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting, because the other thing I learned when I was at NASA was about the NASA spinoff homepage, which is a publication, which is that in, you know, obviously you have the best and brightest, literally rocket scientists working to get people to space and keep them safe once they get there. And it seems obvious that a lot of other technologies that would be relevant just on the planet Earth would evolve out of that. And in fact, that's true. And so there's, you know, if you look at the NASA, it's spinoff.nasa.gov, they have all the technologies that benefit society. Because when you have a bunch of scientists working to accomplish goals, obviously you can find alternative uses for those. So when you just gave some really good examples about understanding the human body on Earth based on what happens in zero gravity.
Right. It teaches us things. But it's part of the reason that it's incredible to be, and it's a privilege, to be surrounded by the great minds at NASA, whether they're engineers or scientists or managers or administrators. It's an organization that attracts some of the best talent in the United States, and there's a reason why NASA is consistently ranked the number one medium government organization to work for.
Mm-hmm. So if there's anyone listening that has any doubts about the human tendency towards stimulation seeking and the needing to continue to discover and move on past things they already know, you and I pretty much know that the limits of people's attention span is about 20 minutes, which is where we are now, because they need to go off into unknown lands. But You know, George, it's been such an honor to talk with you, and we've talked about finding, you know, some other ways of having this conversation. But what would be your kind of final, and maybe kind of bringing it back to my main interest and audience of people that are interested in self-improvement and psychology, what would be your kind of inspirational message to them?
So one thing I want to mention in conjunction with this tie-up is that space tourism is already here.
Okay.
Dennis Tito already paid $20 million to ride a Soyuz craft up to the International Space Station. So people have already paid their way to space.
Mm-hmm.
Virgin Galactic is very close, and you can already pay the Zero-G Corporation to give you a real experience of weightlessness.
Mm-hmm.
So it's here, and going forward, it's only going to get better. But in terms of risk-taking and In terms of risk-taking and exploration, this is something that I think is part of who we are. And I think that you should be emboldened by the things that you see humanity accomplishing, by the things that you see NASA making possible, by the ideas that Mars One is putting forth, and by the very real accomplishments of companies like SpaceX, that what some people tell you is impossible is possible, and you can face down risks and lower them. You can put forth effort and do the hard work necessary to do the impossible in your own life.
Wow. Okay, that's a great place for us to end, because it's you know, the stories that we're talking about prove that that's already been done. So thank you so much, George.
Of course.
Take care.
You too.